I want to start by introducing someone. Her name was Bronnie Ware. Bronnie Ware was a nurse who spent countless hours supporting terminally ill patients in their final 12 weeks of life. So that was her specific role. In her best-selling memoir, she wrote that the top two regrets that people had at the end of their lives were this. Number one, I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends. And number two, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. This is what she says in her memoir. Often, the patients would not truly realize the full benefits of old friends until their dying weeks, and it was not always possible to track them down. Many had become so caught up in their own lives that they had let golden friendships slip by over the years. There were many deep regrets about not giving friendships the time and effort that they deserved. Everyone misses their friends when they're dying. You know, we live in a world where we're constantly distracted, busy, pulled in a million different directions every single day. And in the clutter and noise of our lives, we're bombarded with messages and texts and social media and ads and emails that seem to be urgent and pressing. And I think it makes it hard to discern what we should prioritize in our lives. But I think Bronnie's insights about what truly matters to people at the end of their lives should give us pause and move us to re-examine our own priorities. Because at the end of the day, what will truly matter are the relationships that we cultivated in our lives. You know, when I think about the end of our lives, you know, and we go to Jesus, I don't think Jesus will be like, yo, did you crush it on that project during that work week? Or how much money did you make? I think the question he'll ask us is, how well did you love? Did you love people well? And I think it's telling that the company that you slaved for year after year won't be at your deathbed. It's your friends, your family, your loved ones, the people that you invested in that will be there at the end. Yet, we invest most of our time and energy into our work. Something is backwards here. And it's no wonder why we're in the middle of a loneliness epidemic. But it hasn't always been this way. Throughout most of history, did you know that living alone wasn't even really an option for most people? Instead, humans depended on belonging, living in groups, and cooperating with others for survival and safety. I keep thinking about zombie apocalypses. I think if we had a zombie apocalypse, we'd experience a lot more belonging because you would not be able to survive on your own. And there was a time throughout history where that was actually the case, where people would not live alone. They needed to live in groups to survive. But today, many of us, we have the means now to live on our own, to do life alone, but it comes at a high cost. Sebastian Junger, award-winning journalist, he once said, the accumulation of personal property allowed people to make more and more individualistic choices about their lives. A person living in a modern city or a suburb can, for the first time in history, go through an entire day or an entire life mostly encountering complete strangers. They can be surrounded by others and yet feel deeply, dangerously alone. Think about this for a second. We can go throughout an entire day without having a meaningful interaction with a single person. And many people are opting for this. We work from home. We shop online. We get our food and our groceries delivered. We're on our phones, even when we're with our friends. Modern society, the way it's structured right now, it's structured for disconnection. And unless we prioritize connecting with people in meaningful ways, we simply won't. And this leads us to actually believe that we can live without others. You know, much of the West and many parts of the world have moved away from the tight-knit communities that the generations before us had experienced. You know, when I think about my parents and my grandparents' generation, you know, I think I'm a pretty strong follower of Jesus. I feel like I live to the best of my ability to be a disciple of God. But when I think about my parents and my grandparents' generation, they were hardcore. Like, my grandparents sold all of their belongings in Korea to move our family out here to San Francisco so he could pastor a church. That's just how the generation operated. They gave everything for God and for the church, my grandparents, my parents. And I wondered why. But it wasn't until I got a little bit older when I started to realize that as immigrants, they gave everything to the church because the church was everything to them. It wasn't just a place where they worshiped. The church was literally their family. It was their support system. It was their daycare and after school programs for their kids. It was their safe place where they could speak in their native tongue and eat dishes from back home that they wouldn't be able to eat with anyone else. It was more than just a place where they worshiped or came on Sunday to hear a boring message. It was literally their everything. They experienced belonging to a degree that I feel like most of us in our generation have yet to experience. For them, belonging wasn't a nice to have. It was a necessity. Belonging used to be a higher priority in our society. But since we're now able to meet all of our basic needs on our own, the need for belonging has taken a step back. It's now in the back seat, in the rear view. And now in many ways, we're feeling its effects as loneliness and anxiety have become public health epidemics. And look no further than the global pandemic that we experienced a few years ago in the lockdown, right? The effects with which we're still experiencing today. All this shows us, all this to say, we were made to belong. We were created to be in deep fellowship and community with one another. And so we're in a collection, as you know, called Belong. And as we explore key practices that will help us cultivate a sense of belonging within our community, because how many of you know that belonging doesn't just happen? It takes intention, it takes work, and most importantly, it takes practice. And so we're going to explore practical things we can do in community to create a sense of belonging. And our hope is that at the end of this collection, that you'll feel more than just you're coming to church with strangers. Our hope is that you feel more of a sense of belonging here in our community. And so this week, we're going to focus on the first of five practices. And the first practice is this, priority. Priority is the first practice of belonging because it's what everything else stems from. Let's open up to Hebrews 10, 24 through 25. Very common passage. We've read it a few times here at 99 as well. This is what the author says. And let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another and all the more as you see the day approaching. The author is reminding us that living in difficult times calls for us to prioritize meeting together, continue encouraging one another, to keep seeking belonging. And listen, I get it. Like, I am a parent of two. I know how tiring and how busy life can be. And I understand that there might be 1,000 reasons for us to not prioritize belonging in our lives. Maybe you're busy raising your kids. Maybe there's an illness in your family that requires a lot of your attention. Maybe you're working your butt off at work and just trying to make ends meet, but it's not enough. But I want to propose this. As important as all of those things are, I would counter by asking, don't these things require us to lean into community all the more? How much more do we need community in the journey of raising our kids? How much more do we need community when we're dealing with family issues? How much more do we need community when we're feeling burned out? We need help from those who care deeply about us. We need their prayers. We need their encouragement and support. We need their understanding, empathy, and care. You know, this Lenten season, there were a lot of people in our community, you may not know, going through a lot of stuff. A lot of hard, difficult stuff, people transitioning from job to job, people experiencing pain and illness in their family, people just going through life. And one of the most beautiful things that I saw during this Lenten season is seeing people rally behind and surround the people that needed to be cared for. And now, man, you know, I say it every year, when people are having job issues, we pray through it and fast through it during Lent, and they get a job right after Easter. That happened twice in our community this season. And I believe there's power when people rally around together, when we care for one another, when we encourage one another, when we prioritize deep relationships. Notice that the author of Hebrews didn't say, yo, keep meeting together unless you have kids. Or keep meeting together unless you're tired, or keep meeting together unless you're busy with work. He says, keep meeting together, and all the more as you see the day of the Lord approaching. In other words, prioritize belonging. Corrie ten Boom, she once said, if the devil can't make you sin, he'll make you busy. And there's truth in that, because both sin and busyness have the exact same effect. They cut off our connection to God. They cut off our connection to other people, and they even cut off connection to our own souls. As busy as our lives get, we need to prioritize belonging. So the question, the million-dollar question, how do we prioritize belonging in our relationships? What does it look like to prioritize belonging in our lives? Is it as simple as spending more time with those whom we want to experience belonging with? Now, fun number, okay? If you were to add up all the time spent with your family, at meals, on vacations, in daily conversations, during the first 18 years of your life, you would have lived 157,680 hours. Right? That's a lot of hours. That's a lot of hours. 157,680 hours. Now, chances are that most of us live those hours, our first 18 years of life, in close proximity with our families, right? But yet not everyone has experienced deep and meaningful belonging, even within their families. What does this tell us? What am I getting at? While time and proximity create more opportunities to create deeper connection, they don't necessarily guarantee it. Right? This is true in marriage too. I know there's a few married folks in here. I've heard it time and time again. I've even experienced it, that when you get married, you're around your spouse more than ever before, right? Sometimes more than you want to be. I love being around my wife. I love working with her, being around her all day. But I know some couples, it's hard to do that. You live together, you eat together, you sleep together, you do everything together. Yet oftentimes, couples, I've heard, experience distance because there's no more intentionality, right? The intentional effort put in during the dating period of planning dates, buying gifts, romantic gestures, they begin to wane a little bit. See, we think time and proximity are enough to keep our love burning. That because we're around each other all the time, that it's enough to foster closeness. It's not. And this is what we've gone wrong in the church. We thought, hey, if we could just get you to come to Sunday service every week, if we could just get you to show up to community group every midweek, that somehow magically you would experience belonging. But time and proximity aren't enough. Belonging requires intentionality. What do we do when we show up? What kind of attitude or posture do we show up with? Belonging requires prioritization. In Luke 8, 42 through 48, as Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. Who touched me? Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you. But Jesus said, someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me. Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. Then he said to her, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. The story begins with a bleeding woman in desperation. And we see this image of her pushing through the crowds, the masses of people, just so she could touch the edge of Jesus' garment. And when she finally gets to touch just his clothing, like Jesus' drip was on point, it healed because immediately the bleeding stopped. And as soon as this happens, Jesus asks, who touched me? Who was it? And Peter's like, Jesus, hella people be touching you right now. Like, what do you mean who touched you? Everyone's touching you right now. But Jesus, he replies, someone touched me, for I know that power has gone out from me. So many people were around Jesus touching him, yet only one person came back with a testimony, with a miracle, with a healing. What made her touch so different? I'll tell you. She touched Jesus with intentionality. When she saw that crowd, she knew that nothing was going to keep her from making her way through the masses, even if it's just to touch the hem of his garment. She knew she wanted that healing. And when I think about when people show up to church, you know, some people come like, yeah, it was all right. Like, it was cool. It was good. But when sometimes when people show up, they're like, I'm hungry for something more. I've come and my heart is open. I want God to meet me here. I want him to speak to me. I want him to heal me. I want him to touch me. Sometimes when people come with that kind of intention, those are usually the people that get rocked, that get moved. This woman came with intentionality. She wasn't just trying to touch Jesus because everyone was there. She was desperate to touch him, to meet him. She was intentional. Now, Jesus obviously knew who touched him. Whenever Jesus asks questions, it's not because he doesn't know the answer. It's kind of like he's just that wise sage that like responds in questions, okay? And he knew who touched him. He knew she wasn't only struggling with bleeding, with physical illness, but she knew all about her life, the emotional and social isolation that she was experiencing because of her condition. You know, because of her condition, because of her illness, she was considered by purity laws, Jewish purity laws, unclean. And because of the purity laws in place, she actually, at that time, wasn't allowed to interact with others because she was considered unclean and impure. And she was to be avoided at all costs. Now, think about the context here. This woman, who needs community more than ever, literally cannot find belonging because everyone's supposed to avoid her. Yet what does Jesus do? Jesus, in the midst of a giant crowd, masses of people, he pauses and he highlights this one woman. Jesus was intentionally calling her out of invisibility and connecting with her. She was now seen and known by God. Jesus slowed down and prioritized this woman. The bleeding woman who was rejected, shunned, and isolated from society found belonging again because Jesus prioritized her. That's the power of priority. Dr. Kurt Thompson, he says, we are all born into the world looking for someone looking for us. That could preach. Throughout the Gospels, Jesus shows us that life-giving relationships, they don't come accidentally. They come intentionally. Acts 2:42, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to prayer. Now that word devoted, it actually means perseverance. It means consistency. It means intentionality. It's a beautiful countercultural picture of what it takes to foster deep relationships in an age of distraction and in an age of non-commitment. The early Christians committed themselves to one another no matter what forces came their way. Like, we don't show up for one another when we're tired from the work week. We don't show up for one another when the new episode of Bluey is coming out, right? We don't show up for one another for so many reasons, but the early church, they were showing up for each other with intentionality, despite the risk of being caught and executed for their faith. The word fellowship here in Greek is koinonia. You might have heard the word thrown out. It means an active, dynamic participation in relationships. It's a sharing and giving of ourselves. It's making that relationship a priority. It's more than just coming on a Sunday and leaving before the lights come up after the prayer. It's more than showing up to community group and not saying a single word the entire night. It's an active participation in the relationship to foster that sense of belonging. It's priority. Now, British anthropologist Robin Dunbar, he actually did this fascinating study, and he argues this, that humans have a cognitive limit on how many relationships we can actually maintain. You might have heard of it, Dunbar's number, and he claims it's 150. You can basically only have 150 meaningful relationships in your life at one time. And according to the theory, The intimate circle usually is made up of five people. These are like your ride or dies, your closest friends, the people who know you in and out, which is then followed by a successive layers of 15 good friends, 50 friends, 150 meaningful contacts, 500 acquaintances, and 1,500 people you can recognize. I don't know how they got 1,500. I could barely recognize 100 people. But this, of course, varies slightly based on each individual's personality, capacity, and social wiring. So these aren't like set numbers. And now these numbers have even been debated because of the age of social media. But the point I want us to focus on sharing this number is that we can only maintain so many meaningful relationships at a time. There are only so many people that we can prioritize. We're human and we have limitations, which means we have to be very serious about how we prioritize our relationships. And I don't know if you've ever experienced this. If we're not intentional, we'll find ourselves investing too little in the relationships that mean the most to us and investing way more than we need to in the relationships that aren't as important. And this isn't like a power flex, like, oh, you're more important to me than he is or she is. It's just a matter of stewarding the relationship capacity that God has given you and doing it well. And so today, our challenge in making this a very tangible practice that we can do, we're going to focus on two steps. The first is this. This week, make a list of people you'd like to prioritize in your life. You can use Dunbar's number metrics, like start with the inner circle, close friends, friends, but just make a list of people that God is calling you to prioritize. Remember Jesus, as amazing as he was, he had an inner circle. He had 12 disciples that he focused all of his attention on. And some would argue even within that 12, he had like three people that he really, really invested in, right? And so this is actually biblical. Ask God if there are people that he's highlighting to you in this season to prioritize. And you can organize this however makes sense to you. Think about your friends, your community. Think about key relationships. What comes to mind? Who comes to mind that you want to prioritize today? Is there anyone that God is inviting you to pay more attention to, special attention to in this season? This might include a person or two. Maybe you want to organize it into groups. Sometimes it's just simply coworkers or family members or church members, whatever it might be. You might include groups like your church community group or your housemates or coworkers instead of individuals, whatever makes sense to you. Now, before you say, what's the point of this? Like just putting names on paper. This might seem like a pointless exercise, but there's something powerful about seeing the names of the people most important to you on paper that does something to us. I was overhearing a conversation between our resident lovebirds, Richard and Becca, and they were sharing how, you know, the Chow Gamboa shared that they made a bucket list of their relationship before they decided to have kids and all that stuff. And there, Becca was saying specifically, I hope you don't mind sharing that, there's something about writing down, like, what you want to do, what's on your bucket list, and seeing it tangibly before you, that changes everything. And I think it's the same way. I think we all have a sense of like who's most important to us in our lives, but there's something about putting those names down on paper, seeing them like, oh, this is who God has called me to invest in. These are the people that are most important to me. That does something. You know, for a time when I was leading a discipleship group in college, on my wall in very dramatic fashion with my giant like permanent marker, I etched, like not even on paper, like literally on my wall. I didn't get my deposit back that year. I wrote the names of the 10 people that I was to commit to discipling in this season. And every morning when I would wake up from my bed, I would see those names in bold black permanent marker that represented my $500 deposit that I would not get back. And I prayed for them. I remembered them. I thought some mornings I'd be like, oh, I got to text that guy. Or I got to pray for this person. There's something about putting it on paper, seeing it before you, that causes you to act with greater intentionality. So number one, make a list of the people that God is calling you to prioritize. And number two, structure intentional time with people. When I mean intentional, I mean not just I'm going to see them at work every Monday or Tuesday, or I might see them on Sunday unless they're traveling to Japan. I'm just going to see. No, structure an intentional, consistent time. Hey, once a month, we're going to grab dinner together. Every week, we're going to catch up on phone. Every 3 days, I'm going to send them a text, automated even if you want to, because you're all in tech, right? We can't underestimate the power of structure. Listen, we could have the best relationships in the world, but if you don't commit to setting aside a consistent time and space to build on those relationships, they won't develop into anything substantial. Intentionality requires structure. And in the long run, structure will sustain what we value. David Brooks, he says, thus, the most complete definition of a commitment is this: falling in love with something and then building a structure of behavior around it for those moments when love falters. I'll tell you what, Krista and I, before we got married, we used to ask each other every week, what are three practical ways I can love you better this week? For me, every week, I won't tell you what was on my list, but every week, one was a back scratch for sure. And we kept doing this every week, even when we didn't feel like it. And we didn't really feel the benefits of it until we got married, until life got busy, until church planning, when we didn't have time to focus on each other, when we didn't have time to prioritize different parts of our relationship, but we had this practice that we always fell back on when the feelings of our love fluctuated, when we felt like we were in a valley, right? The structure is important. James Clear, author of Atomic Habits, New York Times bestseller, he says, goals are good for setting a direction, but systems are best for making progress. In other words, if you leave it to whenever we have time, or it'll happen eventually, chances are they won't. It's kind of like I never say, hey, I'll pray for you, because you never do. We don't do it, right? If we say it might happen, well, maybe we'll do it. If we don't actually structure it or systemize it, it won't happen. Right, we've all had friends who've moved away, and without regular, structured, consistent connection, we ended up growing apart. The root word for structure is struct, which means to build. Structure helps us to build our relationships to be stronger and better. And this hard labor of investing in others might be tiring in the moment, but will bear the long-term fruit of belonging. I'm a pastor. And I know I run this church, but there have been many weeks where I don't want to go to community group. I'm just being real here. I'm just being real. Y'all experienced it too. Don't judge me. Where it's just like, it might be nice just to stay in tonight. It might be nice just to catch up on laundry. But you know, I tell Krista, because in this season I've been going, Krista's been staying home. And I tell her every time I come back, I'm so glad I went. Like, have you ever experienced that where like, the barrier to going seems so high and you have to like really emotionally invest in doing it. But then when you do, you don't regret it. And I find most times than not, even though there is a tiring sense of me doing this, even though there's a reluctance, when I do step forward and invest in meaningful relationships, I always almost 9 out of 10 times feel better for it. And I'm glad I did. There's a reason why God uses agrarian metaphors for growth in the Bible, because things take time. They don't happen fast. This isn't microwave fast food faith. Be patient and trust that as you put in the work of priority, belonging will start to grow. And so the second step, just structure time with people God is highlighting for you to prioritize in this season. Maybe it's once a week. You get on that phone call. Maybe it's once a month dinner with your family member, whatever it looks like. And I do want to plug this because I am the pastor of this church. Maybe it's prioritizing community group this season. And I know I say this, but 9 times out of 10, people's experience of community groups was directly correlated to how consistently they showed up. Like even if on paper they were the most random, weird, offbeat collection of people in a group, if people committed to showing up consistently, 9 times out of 10, they experienced a lot better, meaningful experience than people that didn't. So what can you intentionally do to build those relationships that are important to you? Now, before we end, a few things to keep in mind. Number one, not everyone that you prioritize will prioritize you. I had a friend in elementary school, y'all, who I considered my best friend, my bestie, okay? And so every time I'd introduce them, I'd be like, yo, this is my best friend. This is my best friend, Jerwin, okay? This is my best friend. I know it's a weird name, Filipino. Filipinos are the best. They come up with the best names. And I'd always introduce him as my best friend. But I distinctly remember one time he was doing a class presentation and a photo popped up of our friend group. And he introduced each one of us one by name to the class. And when he got to me, he said, this is my friend Mickey. But then when he pointed at our other friend who was next to me, he said, this is my best friend Francis. Gut-wrenching. And that's just life. Not everyone that you prioritize will prioritize you. And that's okay. It might be painful, but take it as an opportunity to move on, not in bitterness, and invest in people who actually want to invest in you too, right? The second thing, look out for toxic or codependent relationships that make it hard to lean into other healthy relationships in your life, that make you experience a false version of belonging that is actually harmful, abusive, and controlling. And choosing to say no to this group, it might be difficult, but it's a necessary thing you need to do to foster healthier relationships outside of that relationship. Third thing, some names and relationships may have changed over time, and that's okay. Someone who used to be in your intimate circle may now just be a good friend. Maybe you moved to a different city. Maybe they got married and started a family. Maybe life just took you on different trajectories. Relationships change. It's a natural part of life. Be grateful and present with the people God's brought before you right now. I think some of the hardest decisions I've had to make is to just let go of people that were really important to me in the past to make space for the people that's before me right now. That's not always the case, but sometimes it requires us to do so. And the last thing, second to last thing, be careful of the posture of picking and choosing as though everyone exists to make your life better. I think sometimes, you know, even as I share this exercise, it could feel kind of like I have a superior mentality, like I get to choose who's important to me. This will condition us to only see our relationships in a self-serving and transactional way. We start to approach our relationships asking, what's in it for me? What can I gain from this person? But this actually ends up limiting our relationships to only those who are useful to us. It's helpful to remember that God's placement of people in our lives isn't random, but rather an intentional invitation for us to be watchful and attentive to the particular relationships he's put on our path. In other words, we have to look around us and see, who has God called me to do life with right now, and where can I experience that life? And last, to assess our relationships, it may be helpful to examine who has historically and consistently shown up in our time of need. I think when we think about people that are really important to us, even just looking through our history together can be very telling. The people that have showed up consistently when we needed them the most, the people who have stepped in when we needed people, a shoulder to lean on, people to talk to. If something were to happen to me right now, who would drop everything to be by my side? Maybe those are the relationships we should be investing in. I want to close by sharing a lyric from a song. In the award-winning Broadway musical Rent, there's a song called Seasons of Love. I loved it. When I was in college, I listened to it all the time. And there's a number that they share in the song. It says there are 525,600 minutes in a year. 525,600 minutes, right? You guys know the song. But the song lyrics are quite profound. They ask, how do you quantify the value of a year in human life? How do you know that that year was well spent? How do you know that you made it matter? And I think there's a deeper commentary throughout the AIDS epidemic of what it looked like to prioritize life and measure it. But the song answers itself in the chorus that the most effective way to measure a life well lived is to measure it in love. In the kingdom of God, a life well lived isn't measured by our successes. It's not measured by accomplishments or our accolades, by how many promotions we get, by how many products we sell, by what kind of name we make for ourselves. It's measured simply by one metric, love. How well did I love my neighbors? How well did I love my family? How well did I love my friends? How well did I love my community and every single person that God has laid before me on my path? And the question, the challenge I want to leave you with as we talk about the practice of priority is, how different would your life look if for the next year, for the next 535,600 minutes, you made belonging a priority? And especially here in the church, What if the kind of relationships that you always longed for in the church is simply a matter of you making a commitment to making this community a priority? And so my challenge is, let's commit ourselves to belonging this year. Let's commit ourselves to prioritize the people that God's put in our lives. And my challenge as the pastor of this church, because you're here on this Sunday, is what would it look like if you prioritize this community?